Hi, this is Megan Francis, and you're listening to the Kitchen Hour podcast. I'm here to keep you company while you get dinner on the table and help you set aside more time for family, food, and fun. Hi, and welcome to episode 11 of the Kitchen Hour podcast. My guests today are Christine Coe and Asha Dornfest, authors of the new book, Minimalist Parenting, Enjoy Family Life More by Doing Less. Hi, guys.
Hello, Megan.
Hey.
I'm so excited to have Christine and Asha here. They're some of my bestest blogging friends, and I was really excited about this book because the concept spoke to me so much. And so I wanted to kind of get their take on why this idea came to them in the first place. And so, Christine, I'm going to have you go first. I just want to hear about your thought process. Did you have like a come to Jesus moment with your own family, or did you observe things happening around you that you just didn't want to go down that path? Or how did this kind of come together for you?
So the idea for the book actually came to me a few years ago. I was at the Blissom Conference in 2010 and had spoken on a panel, and some people had very kindly said, you should write a book. And I didn't, you know, I didn't have an idea for something specifically right in that moment, but maybe a day later, when I was sitting during another session, I just had this, light bulb moment with it. Not only had I been feeling, you know, sort of the painful overwhelm of modern parenting and trying to experiment with how to work out of that, but I had also heard from, you know, my community of readers, similar stories and, you know, rumblings, gentle rumblings of, you know, wanting to find a different way to do things. So after that moment, I drafted a rough outline for the book on the plane ride home and bought the domain name minimalistparenting.com not long after I dropped my luggage in the door. And that's kind of how I do things. And, the book actually laid dormant for a couple of years until, a series of fortuitous events and, you know, connecting with Asha, who I've been friends with, you know, on the internet for many, many years. And it all came together just so beautifully. You know, the book offer, or Asha and I connecting and the book offer and deciding to go through this together. It's just been an amazing journey.
Asha, I would love to hear about what your take was on the idea when you heard about it, or was this something you and Christine had discussed?
This wasn't really something we had discussed ahead of time. We were together at another event, and I think I sometimes wonder if this is how it happened for Christine, but how it looked to me was Christine literally slapping her forehead and going, "Oh my God, I just realized something. You have to co-author this book with me. Let me tell you this idea." It really happened that suddenly, and the most interesting thing for me about it was that the idea of minimalist parenting immediately resonated with me when Christine said those two words together. But the interesting thing for me is that we've both come to this place of feeling this way about minimalist parenting from very different parenting journeys. I mean, we come from very different backgrounds. You know, our upbringings were different. Our children are very different. And even our experience of parenting and working is different. And yet we've both come to this place in such a unified way. It's really, I do sometimes think it was just meant to be.
So Asha, tell me a little bit, because I think sometimes when people hear minimalist parenting, they're like, oh, that means lazy parenting, or that means doing nothing parenting. And that's not what it's about at all. So I would love to hear, Asha, you'd give your take on what it actually means to be a minimalist parent.
A minimalist parent is going to look different for everybody. But what it essentially means to us is, first of all, really confidently being able to identify your priorities, what your family values, what is fun for your family, what's important to your family and you as an individual. And then from there, just clearing the clutter in your life, whether that's your scheduling clutter or clutter in your home or even that mental clutter, just editing your life to the point where there is room for those things that are so important to your family. And, you know, by basically clearing out the stuff that's not so important. You know, we're very overwhelmed by so many choices. It's a wonderful place to be oftentimes, but, you know, with all the choices and all the information, it can obscure what is actually important to us and what we really want to be doing.
Yeah, I so identify with that. And it's, there's this culture of doing more, more, more. And I love that less really is more. It's such a cliche, but it's just so true. And Christine, I wanted to circle back to you because you have an academic background and very I don't want to use the word type. Is it okay if I use the phrase type A? I mean,
it's fine.
Do you identify with that? Okay. So I'm wondering, you know, if this was a harder, you know, for me, like the idea of minimalist parenting, I'm kind of a laid back person to begin with, and I'm very big picture. So for me, it was really easy for me to be like, oh, that's what I do. There's a name for it. Cool. But I'm wondering if maybe there was a bit more of an internal struggle for someone like you who had your crap really together and maybe was putting that image out to the world as well. Like, I can handle all of this stuff and I should, and this is what I'm doing. Talk a little bit about that, Christine.
Well, yeah. First, I would say that I like to refer to myself as a recovering type A and recovering perfectionist because I'm trying to work out of that. And that, you know, this has been and will continue to be, you know, a minimalist parenting journey. I think everybody always has tweaks that they can make. So, yes, when I started parenting, and I refer to this in the book, actually, one of the things that was a natural fallout from me being in research was that when it came to parenting choices, I researched things ad nauseum, and typically spreadsheets were involved. It was quite nerdy. And the sad thing is I would go through all this work to document all these options, and then I'd try to identify the very best thing, and then there always would be something that wasn't perfect about it, and it drove me bananas. And so that there's ever one, you know, best or perfect thing, and, you know, my kids, especially Laurel, my oldest, has been a real teacher for me through a lot of this too.
And during your guys' Twitter party the other day, one of the things that kind of occurred to me is even when you think you've got it all figured out or there is a perfect option, someone's going to come out with a study that debunks it, or the tide is going to move in a different direction and suddenly everyone's like, no, no, no. Actually, this way is best. So there's really, even if you have it all figured out and you've got all the data to support you, you can still end up not with the quote unquote right answer in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would love to hear, Asha, tell me a little bit about the way you guys set the book up. You've got a lot, what I love about this book, but besides all the really reassuring common sense tips in it, is that it's actually sort of a minimalist format. I mean, it's just little easy to read sections. You don't have to devote tons of time when you sit down. It's just really nice because it's just little paragraphs and it's really easy to kind of dive into. So I'd love to hear from you, Asha, like how you guys decided to structure the book. You focused in on things like playtime, finances, mealtime, which of course we'll talk about a little bit, your stuff. Kind of where did you come up with those ideas? Were those the things that you saw other people struggling with?
The actual structuring of the book was a remarkably organic process, which is amazing to say because many authors and co-authors especially, you know, the actual reality of writing the book can be pretty painful. But
right.
Christine and I, you know, we work together shockingly well, and we just thought a lot about the sort of the pain points in our own parenting life, the places the places where we had struggled with either feeling overwhelmed or just feeling like there was, you know, sort of no way to possibly do it perfectly. And we, you know, wrote down those categories, sort of like the major containers of family life. And so we wanted the book to really balance both that sort of philosophical perspective shifting, but then really dive into the practical, you know, tips on what you can start doing in your life gradually to start moving toward a more minimalist approach. So, yeah, we really did start with our own life. And then absolutely we talked to our communities. I mean, we were talking to folks at my blog, Parent Hacks, at Christine's blog, Boston Mamas. We, you know, we're posting questions on our own blog at Minimalist Parenting and really sort of polling people for the things that they were interested in as well. But we did start with our own lives.
Yeah. And I can see that. I mean, there's a lot of you guys written into the book, a lot of your own family experiences and anecdotes. And it, another thing I love about this book, and this is just a little thing maybe as an author that I noticed, but next to each section that one of them authored, there's like a picture of them, which I so appreciate because sometimes you're reading a book with a co-author and you're like, who said that? Who said that part? Who was that? So yeah, I love that. Let's talk a little bit about the meal planning section, and we can all just kind of chime in on this, I think, because, you know, this is something obviously that people who listen to this show are probably thinking about. Was this a pain point in your life before, and for what reason? Like, what was kind of getting in the way of you having a satisfying mealtime? Either one of you take it. Just someone jump in.
Christine, how about I start with this one?
Yeah, that's fine.
I, so pain points around meal planning. So I have two major pain points. One of them is that I, too, am sort of laid back big picture, which means that being systematic about anything is a challenge for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sort of turning something into a routine and making it into a list and sort of turning it into a structured activity is hard for me. I am much more comfortable just like showing up at the store whenever we sort of need food and then,
right.
you know, buying what looks good. That wasn't really working. And I found myself scrambling a lot at mealtime and, you know, oh my God, what am I going to pack in my kids' lunches? So that was the first pain point for me. And the second pain point is that my kids are really finicky. And so I found myself in a situation where I would cook something that I thought was delicious. My kids were
Yeah.
And that is just, that's been an ongoing struggle. And I've come to accept it on some level, but the combination of those things made meal planning, you know, slash grocery shopping slash cooking very frustrating for me. And so it's taken me a lot of time and mental energy to actually get to a point where it's more structured. And actually, I enjoy it a lot more. I especially enjoy it now that my husband's cooking more, too. But yes, that was sort of where I started.
And I'm similar. But, you know, it's funny for me. I found myself, and still do sometimes, kind of vacillating between two extremes. So I'd have completely no organization. I'd be running to the store at 6 o'clock to get dinner, you know, for that night, which, as you know, doesn't really work so well. Or I would have everything planned too much. Like I'd try to overcompensate for my lack of natural organization. And I'd have everything planned out to the ingredient, you know, these kind of elaborate meals. And then the kids didn't like them. I felt so let down. Because I was like, oh, you know, I put so much time into it. So it took me a while to kind of get to a medium area where I can be like, hey, we can eat spaghetti every week. That's okay. Because I know the kids are going to eat it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know.
Yeah.
Indeed. Indeed. And I think, you know, that is a story that we actually tell in minimalist parenting where, you know, in some ways you really can embrace repetition, you know, for some families, it works just fine. I mean, it's funny, we get into this place where we sort of think that we need to be creating, you know, five individual and unique meals each week. And
right.
it doesn't really have to be that way. I mean, you know, really food needs to be nourishing. It needs to be, you know, good. And most people in the family should like it.
Mm-hmm.
Not all.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, we do put so much stock in like new recipes and new exciting ways and, you know, introducing your kids to exotic foods. I'm kind of at the point now where if I'm going to introduce my kids to an exotic food, it's probably going to be taking them to a restaurant because I just don't have the time or the bandwidth at this point in my life to be learning how to like cook Indonesian food. I'm just not there right now. So maybe for a fun habit, you know,
things in time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So chicken and potatoes. I know how to cook that. I don't need to look at a recipe every time. It's like, I just know how to do it.
Megan, I don't know if you've, you know, heard this from your readers, but another sort of dimension of sort of struggles around mealtime that we've discovered recently or in the last year or so is that eat whatever, but then our 8-year-old has been a vegetarian for a couple of years.
Oh,
so
okay.
She's got sort of that specific thing going on. And then our 2-year-old, appears to have both dairy and gluten allergies.
Yeah.
So it just, if you have to, I'm typically all about creating one meal. I'm not a short order cook, that whole thing, but it can be a little complicating. So the crock pot really became my best friend because it could at least eliminate one meal that we needed to prep during that typically very frantic time around, you know, 5:30 or so.
Well, and I think also, you know, cooking additional sides can help with that because mm-hmm. you've got a kid who won't eat one thing, but if you have like three sides to choose from and maybe something, bread or something, unless someone can't eat gluten, but you got to kind of work around these things. And I feel like if I offer a meal that has lots of options, then everyone can just pick what they want to eat and I don't have to stress out about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the really great thing there too, Megan, that you seem to come to, it's taken me longer, is that they can pick what they want and you don't have to stress about it. But, you know, I would find myself stressing if they weren't picking something from all three. And I had these sort of very focused ideas about, you know, they need to eat balanced meals and they need to eat protein with everything and they need to, and, you know, causing that stress at the dinner table, it's just really, you know, I can say now with years of doing it, it really got me anywhere. That they are, their taste really are maturing and they are eating more, but it's going at its own pace that does not seem to respond to my pushing. And so I think it's important to realize that too.
And don't you guys think there's got to be some biological I don't want to say necessity, but there, why would there be so many toddlers who don't want to eat anything but white food or whatever their weird preference? It's almost like there's got to be some evolutionary or biological reason for that, like that we just haven't figured out yet.
That is a topic for another show.
Yeah, yeah, well, know, I don't, like... I don't have any science or I have no scientific background to actually back that up. But it just feels like it's such a normal thing that like there must be something there. It's just, it's been a classic parenting struggle since the beginning, I guess, of meals on a table instead of just going out and finding stuff. So,
although, did you guys see that? I think it was like last year, but there was some post that got, that went viral. It was some, it was images from lunches around the world, you know? Oh, so, no. I mean, it, and it was, I wish I could remember where I saw it, but it was really amazing. So like, you know, I'm Korean, so like Korea would be, you know, noodles and vegetables, steamed vegetables and all these other things. And, you know, sort of things that you would classically expect. And then, you know, the, and these were lunches, I think, served in schools.
Okay.
Beautiful varieties.
Oh,
all
yes,
different countries.
I did see that.
And then
yeah.
the one for U.S., of course, was
like nuggets.
Nuggets and hot dogs and gross.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm not saying that's normal either. I mean, that's definitely, but I just think there's some, like the element of a little bit of pickiness as kids are figuring out. I mean, I remember when I was little, things tasted different than they taste now. You know, a Brussels sprout when I was 10 years old. Tasted so intensely horrible. Now I love them. I mean, it's like, you know, it's something developmental was going on during that time. So, and also I think sometimes, you know, you have to like look at it over the course of a week. It's not what they eat in that meal or what they eat even maybe in that day, but what's the overall picture look like?
I have to say, I feel like this is a perfect example of one thing I have found with parenting, and it speaks to minimalist parenting, which is sometimes there are forces at work that are much larger than just our individual choices and our individual decisions. And you have to trust that the development will happen, the tastes will mature, that the learning will happen. I mean, I had the same Brussels sprout experience. I am obsessed with Brussels sprouts now, and I hated them as a kid. And, you know, and here I am getting frustrated with my own children. And really, you know, there is a certain amount of trust that needs to happen that we are meant to evolve and mature. And that's exactly what our children are doing, too.
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, when I get mad at, like, my kids for not wanting to try something, I just think back to what it felt like as a kid, like, to think, how could anybody like this? It's so bad. So it's, you know, it's sometimes you got to put yourself in your kid's shoes a little bit and just remember that, gosh, that intense, like, I can't do it. I can't choke it down. And, you know, your mom would be like, drink a glass of milk with it. So it's like swallowing peas. Oh, yeah. But, you know, I love, and Asha, that speaks to like the larger point, I think, that trust. And I would love to kind of get into now a discussion about how, you know, besides the food thing, but it's a really great example Christine brought up of that cultural force at play. So like, you know, our kids are being served certain kinds of foods. Our kids are being bombarded with certain kinds of messages. Our kids are in this frenetic pace. And so we don't all have the option of like just moving off the grid and, you know, living on a goat farm or something. So nor would I want to. So how have you found that you can kind of parent the way you want to while all these forces are going on? And just whoever wants to jump in, go ahead.
Yeah,
that's, for that, Christine.
I can try. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's such a good question. And it's really, really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, when everybody's doing one thing, it really does trigger that, oh, should I be doing that? Mm-hmm. Am I a bad parent if I'm not doing that? And for me, particularly because I think my early parenting was also rooted in a lot of overcompensation for, you know, things that I didn't have during my own childhood, I've had to come to realize that, you know, everybody, and trust in the fact, it's, this is a little high level, but trust in the fact that everybody is doing their own thing for reasons that I will never fully understand. You know, they'll have their own, you know, internal baggage, they'll have their own goals, perhaps their own kids, you know, have preferences that I don't know about. You know, somebody, I was doing a talk last night and somebody was asking me about the whole tiger mom phenomenon. And, you know, I think they were basically asking, you know, do you think the tiger moms are horrible? And I said, you know, I am not in a place to really even evaluate that, because who knows, maybe a tiger cub is really actually into violin lessons and we just don't know. So I think my point is that there are usually many factors at play that the rest of us don't even know about.
I totally agree. And the, for me, the tiger mom thing was, sort of what I took away from that is that, gosh, I wouldn't want to live that way, but that doesn't mean that those kids are going to grow up hating their mom or that they're getting a worse childhood. It's a difference in values. And I definitely want to keep talking about the outside pressures, but I'm going to sidetrack a little bit here. And I want to talk about the idea of values, because that's something you guys talk about in the book. And I think sometimes we have this idea that a value is like a judgment, like, oh, my values are this, this, and this. And then we can like judge each other's values when really it's just what's important to you. You know, it's not, if you value really healthy food and that's your number one value, then that's how you're going to shape your life. But that doesn't mean that you're wrong and I'm right because my value is education or whatever, you know. So how did you kind of come to that, you know, to talk about values, and how does that work in your book? Because it seems like the driving force.
You know, that's funny you should say that, because I actually kept stumbling over the word values for exactly that same reason. I mean, I think the term, quote unquote, family values got politicized at one point. And so it does seem like sort of an us versus them. You know, we have values and therefore we, you know, live this way. Clearly you don't have values. Right. And that's not exactly at all what we're talking about. And you hit it on the head that, you know, for us, the definition of values is simply, what do you value? What is important to you as a family and also as an individual? What do you, Megan, Christine, and value in your life, because that's the stuff you want to make room for. And so we tried to really make that clear in the book, that when we're talking about values, we're not talking necessarily about very lofty sort of, look down at the world from 10,000 feet type ideas. We're talking about simply the things that you want to make room for in your life every day. And that's an important distinction to make.
Mm-hmm.
Very important.
And that really takes the pressure off, too. You know, it makes it something you do instead of, like, something I believe.
Right, exactly. And it also helps you, it helps you make decisions. And I think that, you know, when you look at somebody else and when you talk about, let's say, tiger moms, and you say it's just a difference in values, it's also a difference in, you know, there's a cultural specificity to that type of parenting as well. You know, so in a particular culture, a particular type of parenting is going to fit. And in, you know, sort of modern American culture, another type of parenting is going to fit. And we have more, you know, wiggle room. So what that means is, you know, the good side is that we have more choice, but the bad side is we can also flail around not knowing how to choose, you know, amongst all the different, you know, options out there. And so defining your values, defining what's important to you, helps you choose.
And you know, when choice is really a mixed bag, because when you have so many choices, you think, well, the perfect one is out there. I just have to look harder. So it is a mixed bag. And Asha, you were starting to talk about, you know, getting back to this idea of the culture, and Christine spoke a little bit about the pressures that parents have. I'm wondering if you're noticing your kids at all being like, hey, how come everybody else does more activities or, you know, goes on bigger vacations or whatever it is? Have you gotten any pushback from your children because they feel that what you're doing isn't fitting in with the larger culture?
That's a great question. You know, I personally do not, because my kids happen to really with open space. So, you know, much of this really was, you know, much of this sort of parenting philosophy really came from them. Not so much, you know, I have a value for open space. I will therefore impose open space upon you. It was more like, you know what? We get overwhelmed when there's too much going on. Neither of my kids happens to be really into sports. However, one is now learning to play the fiddle, and the other one is studying for a bar mitzvah. So definitely there's stuff going on, but they are the ones actually who made pretty clear that, you know, they don't want our weekends completely full with four activities and all this other stuff. So no, I am not feeling that for my kids, although I have heard from other parents that some kids do. So I it's not to say it doesn't happen.
I think the athletic thing really, and my kids aren't particularly athletic. They've all dabbled. I think that the athletics can really be a pinch. If a kid really wants to be in a certain sport, they get so intense at such a young age that they're like either in it, all in, or they're out. You know, it's like they have to decide, am I going to devote my life to this or not do it at all? And that's unfortunate, I think, that there aren't more options for kids who just kind of want to play sports and be athletic.
Yeah.
But not necessarily be like, you know, elite.
Yeah, I think it's a shame too, because, I mean, I think you can discover, you know, later on, you can discover that you have a passion for sports or something. I mean, I know I grew up and was completely not athletic or never considered myself to be. And, you know, we didn't have the resources to sign up for teams and things like that. And it wasn't until grad school that I you know, I joined an intramural soccer team. I didn't know how to play, but I just learned there. And then I started running, and I actually discovered that I actually could move and was, you know, reasonably coordinated. And so it was great. So to me, that was just evidence that you can pick stuff up anytime. You know, it's not like if you don't do it between ages, you know, I don't know, 6 to 10, you're totally sunk. I mean, sure, I guess that's different if you have really big goals about, you know, competitive elements, but you know, for the regular person, I think, you know, you can pick stuff up anytime.
For us normals.
I'm happy to be normal.
You know, that's really interesting though, because there are those people, a number of people have said to us, but you know, won't your kids miss out? Won't they miss out on the fact that all their friends are doing this? And aren't you stifling your children or holding them back? And, you know, we really believe in letting the kids lead on this. Mm-hmm. You know, some kids really do thrive with a lot of activity. But I think they need to understand that it does affect the whole family if the whole family has to trudge along to 3 practices and 2 games per weekend.
Right.
And so that is a conversation that needs to happen. I think the thing is that so many parents sort of make it an automatic thing, like, well, they want to be in soccer, but you have to sign up for soccer.
Right.
It doesn't have to be like that. And I think that it is worth having those conversations with your kids. And it's worth really balancing what those time and, you know, space demands are going to be along with everything else that's going on in your family.
Well, and you know, it's funny.
Basically giving yourself a vote again.
Kids want a lot of things. I mean, my kids would have a birthday party every day. They would like to try every single sport and activity at least once. But that doesn't, like you said, Asha, it's not just because they want to do something doesn't mean that's a passion, that's going to be their future. Like, you know, you do have to really... Because otherwise they would want to sign on. My kids would sign on for everything. But they'd regret it like a week in.
Well, that's really true. And I think, you know, it is not that we are anti-sports. You know, I sort of joked at one point with my neighbors who have very sports-involved kids. And they were getting pretty tired. They, meaning the whole families, were getting tired of all the practices and everything. I mean, the kids are really into it and very talented. And I said, you know, sports are anti-family values. I was just joking with them. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, for them, they chose to make sports. That was their value. And they chose to minimize other things.
Right.
So for them, it really worked. But again, it was a conscious choice for that family. And it really worked for their kids who are passionate basketball players. And that just doesn't happen to be the choice for us. So again, it is not about the specific choice. It's about being conscious and mindful about what your values are before you make that choice.
I love that. I have to take a quick break, but we will be right back. I really want to talk more about this idea because now my brain is just spinning with all of what you just said, Asha, about this idea of the family unit and how that's really the important thing. Not what you do necessarily, but the fact that you're doing it as a family and as a conscious thing. So we'll be back in just a couple of seconds. Hang in there. Hi all, Megan here. Hey, did you know that there are recipes on thekitchenhour.com? I've got a few from some of our guests on the shows. Like, for example, I've got a French onion soup from Food Network star Melissa D'Arabian and Grandpa pancakes from Kelly Hampton. I've also got a couple of my own recipes. Like, recently I put up my epic bacon, egg, and blue cheese green salad recipe, which makes a really nice, hearty meal. You can have it by itself for lunch or with your dinner. It's yummy, and really, who doesn't love adding bacon to pretty much anything? Go ahead and check it out. It's at thekitchenhour.com/recipes. Thanks, and back to the show. Hey, we're back with episode 11 of the Kitchen Hour podcast. Again, my guests today are Asha Dornfest and Christine Coe, authors of the new book, Minimalist Parenting, Enjoy Modern Family Life More by Doing Less. If you've been listening up to the break, you would have heard us talking about everything from food to sports. And we were actually just kind of finishing up a conversation about sports, but it made me think of this idea that I've kind of had rattling around in my brain lately that this conversation is really kind of solidifying, in that what I'm really trying to do with my family is make us sort of family and inwardly focused. And what I find nowadays, and you ladies can speak to this, is that I feel like there's a lot of pressure for all of us to be sort of like satellites. You know, we're not like a unit. We're like all these like, you know, disparate parts, and like everyone's kind of going out. And I'm really trying to bring us all back in. So that's like when I really think about my parenting philosophy or how I want my family life to be, if we're all going to do, you know, everyone's of course is going to have their own activities, but like, I really want it to be something that we're all involved in, and the unit is more important than the, you know, than the individual. So I would love to hear your guys' thoughts on that kind of idea of a strong family.
Christine, I can begin this
sure.
by saying that one of the great benefits of the way it looks in my family, minimalist parenting in my family looks like a lot of open time in the schedule.
Okay.
So what that means is there is plenty of time. Well, and the other thing is my husband and I both work from home. So I realize that that is a pretty privileged position yes. to be in. But we are able to come together at some point each day and really spend time as a foursome. You know, I have two mm-hmm. children. Every Friday night, we're Jewish, so we observe Shabbat, which is, you know, sort of like the traditional Sabbath. It's very, very low-key. You know, we have a special dinner every night. On Fridays, we have board games. So there really is the time and the ability, literally just the logistical ability to come together and do that stuff. Now, I'm not saying it has to be like that for everybody. It's not like, you know, we are, you know, waving the flag of everyone must have a sit-down dinner every night. You know, again, it's going to work out differently for everybody, but it has made it so that those jaunts out from the family, you know, whether it's for violin lessons or, you know, things that each of my kids are interested in that the other one's not interested in, you know, outings or whatever, you know, it's almost like day trips away from the family base, you know,
right.
as opposed to like your satellites that are sort of spinning in their own orbits and that, you know, sometimes collide maybe once a week.
Right.
And we do feel closer as a family. I mean, you know, then again, things happen to be going smoothly right now. I mean, there were a number of years in my family where my husband, you know, was in the middle of, you know, an internet startup and my son was having some pretty major health problems. That was a traumatic time. And so during that time, you know, we sort of minimalized our life mm-hmm. Out of necessity more than out of choice. So, you know, it's not like it's always been, you know, this happy little, you know, cheerful place,
right.
but it really has solidified us as a unit.
Well, and that's a really important point too, is that you're not always going to, I mean, everything's not always going to be buzzing along smoothly. Everyone's, you know, holding hands, skipping through a field. There's going to be a strong family is going to go through hard times, but I guess what defines a strong family is that they can bounce back afterward and still come back together. And they can kind of pull through it together instead of everyone mm-hmm. just bleh. You know?
Yes, they can pull through it together, and there's room for people to be individuals inside a family like
right.
this. Because, you know, some families just seem to sort of, you know, four sort of perfectly compatible individuals. You know, my family is composed of four extremely different people with different interests, different proclivities, different perspectives. You know, my son could not be more different than me. And frankly, same with my husband. And believe me, it took a long time for us to find, you know, sort of that place in the middle where we all feel good together, but we have found that. But the point is that it took space. It took time and it took space to be able to do that. And I think if we were all four of us constantly on the go everywhere, we wouldn't have had the ability to create those, you know, sort of like the connective tissue, if you want to put it sort of in a disgusting way. That's what sort of made it possible for us to, I think, deal with those hard times.
Yeah. I like that. Go ahead, Christine.
So lately I've discovered in terms of, you know, being present and really mindful about, you know, family moments and being together, that our two-year-old has become something of a barometer in this respect, in the sense that John and I have noticed that if we're both bustling around, whether it's, you know, dinner or just tidying or whatever, she gets very noisy and demanding and just difficult to, you know, settle down. But the moments when all four of us, if we're all four playing at the same time, and whether we're doing puzzles or sitting and reading or whatever, the whole tenor of the evening will take on a different, it'll just be lovely. So it's made us realize, you know, sometimes when we're together, especially at the end of a crazy day, you just, you know, the dishes and stuff can wait, and
yeah.
you just need to sit down and just be there.
And that brings me to something that you write about in the book, that I think, you know, engaging the kids in the kitchen, and that's something that can be difficult to do. I admit it. I've got five kids, and when I'm in the kitchen, sometimes I'm like, out, just leave. I want to get this done, you know. But I do notice that if I bring them in and give them something to do, or even if they're just unloading the dishwasher and we're chatting, it might be like a little more, you know, frenetic for a second, but it's so valuable. So talk about that a little bit, one of you. Asha, go ahead. Like, how did you kind of come to that?
Let's just say it's been a long-term process. Yeah. So I think number one, first of all, when you have those feelings of just like out of the kitchen, you know, kicking them out of your space, first of all, that is totally fine and worthwhile. And sometimes we really do need a moment to ourselves. Believe me, I understand that. And I think that's good. However, I also think as the mother of two very finicky children, that it seems the more they get involved in very small ways. So I'm not talking about right away getting them in here doing major kitchen labor. I mean, small ways, whether that's helping choose food at the grocery store, maybe taking them to the farmer's market, you know, or actually in the kitchen, you know, something really simple like slicing some cheese or taking something out of the oven. My kids are older, so that's, I can do that. Even getting them to sort of look and smell, even if they're not even that involved right at the beginning, helps. Or like you said, emptying the dishwasher and chatting while we're cooking. Just getting them in the kitchen and seeing what's happening somehow helps them be a little bit more engaged, you know. And there's also sort of this whole area surrounding the kitchen. So the table, setting the table, you know, all that kind of stuff. I am finding that mealtimes are actually feeling more cohesive because that's happening. Also, clearly a function of them getting older too. Absolutely. Right. You know, when you have four-year-olds, you know, 2-year-olds and stuff, it's not like you have a nice, calm, sweet dinner every night. We know that, right, you know, let's be realistic.
Well, and I think it's also so important for them to understand what goes into making the meal. And so even if they're just kind of doing a very small part of it, but observing it, I find that it makes the kids appreciate it a lot more than if I just kind of hold them off, like, go play video games while I cook, and then here's a meal. It's like they really do kind of think it just magically somehow appeared out of nowhere.
I spin it as move out skills to my son. Yeah. My son's in middle school, and I'm like, dude, your roommate will love you if you know A, how to wash a dish, and B, how to cook a meal. You know, so it's really for him. It's all about, you know, these are independent skills, and so believe me, he's much more motivated to learn about it.
Now, Christine, you have a 2-year-old. So how does that look for you? I can't. It's so funny. My 4-year-old is my youngest, and I'm already forgetting what it was like to have a 2-year-old. Not the same.
Actually, it's very cute. You know, she understands so much. I mean, it still blows my mind how much toddlers actually understand, you know, more than they can verbalize. But, you know, she'll help clear her. If we ask her to clear her dish from the table, she'll take it to the sink. I mean, sometimes there will be spills along the way, but, you know, whatever. We don't care. It's more about the process for us and getting her to help. So they can definitely do that. I think, you know, Laurel, I actually had her. I was probably more proactive about having her in the kitchen with me very early. And so she's got mad, like, baking and cooking skills. It's really crazy. Oh. So she's made us dinner. You know, she can make chocolate cake from scratch. She can, you know, do a lot of things. And, you know, besides the actual payoff of those skills, another side effect that I've found is that there's something about when you mentioned chatting, you know, chatting while you're unloading the dishwasher. I think there's something very powerful about working together, but not having to look each other in the eye the whole time. That allows for conversations that otherwise wouldn't happen. So I've learned about, you know, some of my daughter's school conflicts and things that she might have been more hesitant bringing up, but sort of couched in this scenario where we're both doing something.
Yes.
It's easier to talk about.
And I'm noticing that more and more now that my boys are teenagers. They'll just kind of naturally let things slide. Like, it's like that or when we're driving in the car. You know, they don't have to look. It's not that pressure. Like, I'm like, hey, what happened to you today? So it's, you know, it's just a lot more.
Tell me about your life.
Tell me about your life. Tell me about the worst thing that's happened to you all week. They're not likely to really open up. But there is that natural rhythm. And you were mentioned, you know, you're talking about your 2-year-old. I was just remembering this post I wrote when Clara was maybe 20 months, 22 months. Which, by the way, for me was like the worst part of parenting. That was always the worst period from like about a year to about like 22 months when they were just sort of a mass of nerves and impulses, you know, like every ability, but no common sense. Gosh. So I have this picture of Clara sitting on the counter. It was a post about just kind of how to work around, and I'll link it in the show notes. But it was a post about how to work around your kids in the kitchen, and I would just stick her on the counter because I was like, well, I mean, that's kind of novel. If I'm right here, she's not probably going to fall off. She never did. And I would just like shove her all the way back and hand her like some tongs and a doll or something. So the picture I have of her is her giving her doll a lobotomy with the tongs and, you know, she's like hitting it in the head really hard. But she loved it. She just liked being eye level and not always. And then I didn't have a baby with their arms wrapped around my legs, which is like maybe one of the worst feelings. Like when you're trying to do something like, I have to get this roast out right now. Mm-hmm. And there's a toddler behind you with, you know, like a lock on your legs. Ugh, frustration. So,
you know, I have to add a personal story into this particular conversation because my dad, who is from India, he is not a super talkative guy. He is very quiet, strong, silent type. I grew up leaning against the refrigerator, watching him cook. Mm. My dad's an incredible cook. And so much of the quality time that I spent with my dad was literally me staring at him stirring a pot. And he wasn't talking to me. He wasn't particularly interacting with me. Sometimes he'd say, hand me the salt. And that was about it.
Yeah.
But I will tell you how much I value that time that I spent with him. And I think it's so important to really know as a modern parent that quality time can be emptying the dishwasher and having our children stare at us while we're cooking.
I love that. Because Disneyland, we put so much pressure on ourselves, you know?
Of course they do. Or they somehow think that, you know, again, my kids are missing out because, you know, somehow fireworks and violins aren't playing. Right. It's like, no, no, no. It's actually those in-between moments that magic happens in those moments. Not always. And it might be invisible, but it's so important to have those times.
Yes, I totally agree. And you know, another thing that I just read a story last week, and I don't know if you all read it. I can't remember if it was in the New Yorker or New York Magazine or possibly the New York Times. It was something with New York in the title. But it was about family stories and how much kids who have a shared sense of like a narrative. So yes. Families who have a narrative, like how important that is. And I think, gosh, that's one of the things that I want to create by slowing down, creating space and allowing things to just happen. You know, that's where those stories come from.
Family narrative is so important. I've actually heard this, you know, from a therapeutic standpoint when there was, you know, sort of therapy involved in my children's lives. You know, one of the things that this counselor said was, you know, one of the ways that children feel together in a family is when they can say, our family does this, our family does that, and they have a cohesive something to talk about, whether it's a tradition or a simple thing like, you know, I do chores every day after whatever. You know, that cohesive ability to feel like you belong is crucial.
Yes.
It is so important. And it can, so, and it's the most important thing is it's so simple.
It's so simple. Yeah.
It's so simple. I would hate for people to, you know, listen to what we're talking about here and say, oh God, you know, I'm a loser. I don't involve my kids in the kitchen. I don't do this. I don't do that. I mean, no, it just starts small, little tiny, those moments that you spend, they're tiny and they're easy.
And but it really does start with having those moments, and that's what minimalizing is all about, is making space for them. Because if you're running, you know, then you just don't have time to breathe and think about, or even like allow those things to happen. If there's so much noise going on and so much activity, you guys should see me gesturing over here. Sometimes I wish you could like see me on camera for like 2 seconds because my hands are going like I'm a tap dancer going around in circles right now. I look goofy. But I love that. I love the story that you just told, Asha. That's just really drives home the point that it doesn't always have to be so orchestrated and overthought, you know?
You know, I think in my case too, you know, in the case of my dad that I just shared, the other thing is that was something that was authentic to him. You know, my dad was cooking because he loves to cook. He is a gifted cook. And he was not cooking because he felt it was an important parental value to involve me in the kitchen. Just wanted the damn salt.
Right.
and so this was really actually coming from a place of utter and total authenticity from him. And so he was enriching himself by cooking, and he was also enriching me simply by me being present and there being time for that space. So, you know, again, the specifics are going to look different because we're all different, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I don't happen to be. I mean, I'm an okay cook, but I'm really good. Actually, I'm really great in nature and sort of adventures with my kids. So that's one thing I like to share with them. Mm-hmm. Other people don't do that. So you know, it's not about you know, you have to do these, you know, things on this list. It's you have to identify what what brings you joy and include your kids in that.
It's like the best version, the best mom you can be is like just being yourself. Really being yourself, and that will speak so loudly to your family.
Right.
And so I'm going to switch gears just a little bit here because we've been talking a lot about our kids and we've been talking a lot about taking care of them and how to make space for them. But I know for myself, one big thing, and I know you write about this in Minimalist Parenting, is you have to really take care of yourself, fill your own well. And sometimes that also means asking the family to sacrifice a little bit or to make time for you or make space for you to do that. So Christine, can you talk a little bit about the self-care aspect of this?
Yeah. You know, we devote an entire chapter, the final chapter and, for self-care in this book. And it's really important to us. And Asha and I joke, she calls me the self-care queen, and it's not because I get weekly manicures. I wish I did. My cuticles actually look horrible right now, but it really is, as you just, you know, mentioned that the family is a part of it. Like so many things, I mean, probably like everything, you know, it's a family system. And if you are in a very bad place, whether that's emotional or physical or whatever, I mean, that's not good for everyone, for anyone. I will share that actually this morning I fell down the stairs again for the second time, like in a year. I don't know what is wrong with me, but the reaction that I got from John and Laurel, who were at the bottom of the stairs, it was very clear to me. I mean, they both were like, if you die, we will be really sunk. And so anyway, so it's true. We really believe in this.
Yeah, I so agree with that. And you know, it is, it's modeling that for your children so that they grow up doing it as well. And also just, and again, it brings you back to the unit is more important than the individual. So like your kids' activities can't trump, you know, your need for some exercise or, I don't know, maybe a pair of shoes with better tread so you don't fall down the stairs again. Were you perchance?
My in-laws were here, and they were like, "Oh my gosh, what just happened?"
Were you
like,
perchance walking down the stairs in socks? Because I don't do that anymore. Like I will
was,
not walk down.
And that was my problem. Actually, the irony: I was walking down the stairs in my running socks because I was getting ready to push Violet to school so I could run home. You know, self care.
Yeah.
And I, you know, fell down the stairs.
And you're probably feeling all peppy and energetic, and like I'm gonna take these stairs, and then stairs took you. Yeah. Asha, do you have anything to add about self-care?
Just that when you make space in your life to reserve some of that space for yourself and realize that it is in no way selfish to do that. That it is, you know, a family is made up of individuals and each of those individuals, including you, needs to have space to thrive and to be healthy and, you know, and to be well.
I so agree. And even finding ways to make things that are part of your sort of job as a parent, more about you. So that's kind of like why I even came up with this idea of doing the kitchen hour, because I was finding that being in the kitchen was a drag. And I thought, I want to make this more enjoyable for me. How can I make this enjoyable for me? Well, I'm going to like, you know, maybe drink a glass of wine. I'm going to listen to a podcast. It actually becomes sort of some of my fun time. So there are ways you can even take things and like turn them on their heads sometimes. Things that are a chore or a drag or, you know, something that you're doing for somebody else. I talked to moms who, instead of feeling they have to go and watch a practice, they sit in the car and read their Kindle or, you know, it's like just finding ways to kind of incorporate that into your day.
You know, and I think too, it's important to realize that as kids get older and don't need as much direct, you know, direct help or playtime, I have to say my kids really get, they get of jazzed when they see me excited about something. So when I'm doing something that I'm interested in that they may or may not be interested in, they're at least, I think, really excited to see me engaged with something. I think it's the best kind of modeling to let them see that, you know, each of us has our own passions and our own interests, and they may change and they may stay stable, but, you know, modeling for them that this is energy that they are going to have for themselves at some point. They are going to be able to identify those things and make space for themselves.
I love that. We're going to be wrapping up pretty soon, but I'm thinking there might be some people listening to this going, you know, this all sounds great, but I'm really overwhelmed by this idea because where do I go from where I am now, feeling overwhelmed or feeling frazzled? How do I get to this minimalist parenting sort of ideal I have in my head? And you guys actually have something called Min Camp, which is a free daily, it's a daily. So Christine, you tell me about it because you're going to do it better than me.
Sure. it's really great. It's a free online companion to the book. It's a 14-day, you know, exercise. And you can just sign up at minimalistparenting.com/mincamp. It's very simple. And when you sign up, it'll fire off in 14 days, 14 emails with very doable tasks that will help you make change. And it's in the domains of food, time, clutter, self-care. And, you know, we kicked off MinCamp, the sort of inaugural round of it, on March 1st. And it was just sort of, I had sort of hoped that maybe, you know, 25 or 50 people, maybe including some of my family, would join. over 1,500 people signed up. And were sharing on Twitter and Facebook, and we were talking about it. And it was just remarkable. And people were saying, this is life-changing. I think sometimes it's just when you have, I mean, obviously parenting, very big concept. When you have that is so much a part of everything you do, it can be very overwhelming to figure out where to start. And I think, you know, MinCamp just, you know, Asha and I were trying to think of something fun and, you know, actionable and something that would really help people in very small windows of time. And I think this really helped a lot of people just get started and to see that they could really make a difference in their lives in very short windows of time. So, I mean, we were just so thrilled and so honored to be a part of so many people's journeys during MinCamp.
So is it something where you can sign up at any time and it'll take you through the 14 emails, or does it start at a certain time and end at a certain time?
Nope, you can start. You can sign up and it'll start firing off. Okay. You'll get a welcome email, and then the next day you'll get your first task.
Cool. All right, and I will link to that and all the things that we've talked about in the show notes, which will be at thekitchenhour.com/episode11. So, ladies, I hate to break this up because I'm having so much fun with you, but we're getting close to the hour mark. I wanted to ask if there's anything we didn't talk about today that you know, close final thoughts or anything that you kind of want to make sure that we talk about that I didn't get to. Anybody?
I would say that for anyone who's feeling overwhelmed, you know, you need to know that both Christine and I at various points in our parenting life have also felt overwhelmed, and we still do sometimes, absolutely, and that this is really the beginning of a journey. You know, it's not like something that you have to accomplish in 6 weeks or anything. It's a way to sort of rethink your approach to parenting and your own self-care, and, you know, that any small step in that direction is a major victory.
Love that. Christine?
I agree. And I'm grateful for people who are tuning in. Megan, I'm grateful for you, you know, for giving us the chance to talk about this book. It's, I really feel like this book was a community effort from start to finish, you know, from the inspiration to, you know, the contributions to the, you know, groundswell in response to the book. And so I think this is as much, you know, a book for everyone out there as it is ours.
That's great. Ladies, this has been really fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us. Wonderful.
Thanks so much for joining me for this week's episode of the Kitchen Hour podcast. To find out more about the guest I spoke with today and some of the things we talked about, you can find the show notes for this episode and all episodes of the Kitchen Hour podcast at thekitchenhour.com/podcasts. Thanks, and see you next time.